How can we design spaces that make us measurably healthier, happier, and more productive? Join us on Built for Health, where we talk with public health professionals, researchers, and AEC practitioners on the latest knowledge and strategies to design, build, and operate healthier buildings. I'm Flavia Gray. I'm a Schneider Fellow at USGBC, and I'll be your host on Built for Health, brought to you by USGBC. Hello, and welcome to the Built for Health podcast. I'm Flavia Gray, and in today's episode, we talk about air quality with Professor Jack Spengler from the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and Adamina Rodriguez, founder and CEO of AR Green Consulting in San Francisco. They will tell us about their professional journeys, how air quality impacts our health and well-being, three issues to be aware of, and the best strategies to address them.
Hello, everyone. My name is Adamina Rodriguez. I am the founder and the CEO of AR Green Consulting, a sustainable consulting firm based in San Francisco that focuses on green buildings design and construction. I am an architect and a civil engineer from Spain and started working in the construction industry in green buildings in the US in 1999 after doing my graduate studies at Northwestern University. In terms of health, I was one of the founding members of the Building Health Initiative by the USGBC in Northern California chapter in 2013, and I am part of one of the first groups of the well-accredited professionals worldwide. And for anyone that doesn't know what WELL is one of the most widely used green building rating systems that focuses on human health and well-being. It's designed to work with the LEED certification. So in my 20 plus years career in the green building industry, I got to appreciate firsthand what the huge impact there is from the built environment on human health and the importance of maximizing the way that we design, build, and operate the buildings so that we are all, to make them sustainable.
Sure, I'm Jack Spengler. I'm the Akira Yamaguchi Professor of Environmental Health and Human Habitation at the Chan School of Public Health at Harvard. I've been on the faculty for a couple of decades, and we'll just leave it at that. And I think apropos to indoor environments, I think my interest, professional research interest, came out of our work on outdoor air pollution health that we were doing in the 70s and 80s, looking at children and adults and the effects of particles and gases on their respiratory health and then mortality. And it dawned on us that, well, where do we spend our time? And it turns out it's indoors. So we started shifting our emphasis to making indoor measurements. So we did a lot of work now over the years in all sorts of indoor environments, from homes to schools to office buildings to airplanes to cars and hospitals and gymnasiums. And so I found this as a great adventure in many ways, because we're discovering new things along the way. Participated in National Academy studies, World Health Organization studies of sick building syndrome and various things. Editor of the Handbook of Indoor Air Quality. So I've been, involved in our indoor environment for many years, and find that we still have new things to think about and to be concerned about.
Thank you so much. We're so excited to have both of you here to educate us a little bit about air quality and why should we care. So why don't we start with that? And Jack, tell us a little bit about the basics. You know, why do we care about air quality?
Well, let me take the big perspective is that, you know, we have a hubris of our frailties of being humans. And we look at the vast atmosphere around us and feel no restrictions about what we dump into the atmosphere. So for a long time, we've been discharging our exhaust from our cars, from our power plants, from our industries, into the atmosphere or into rivers and oceans. So this is catching up with us. And so the World Health Organization has looked at the burden of disease and says that air pollution is one of the leading causes of mortality in the world. And if you look at more details, it's both outdoor air pollution, from our dirty cities, as well as indoor air pollution from the things we burn inside our homes. And there's several billion people in the world still has that. So that's the broad perspective. And I think we don't think about that in developed world. We think our air is relatively clean. We think our houses are safe, our buildings are safe because someone's looking after this. Not the case. There are many things that we find in much higher concentration indoors than we even find outdoors. So that's the broad perspective, I think.
So what are some of these things that we find indoors and how do they affect us?
The main sources of contamination that we find indoor could be coming from the outdoor. As we do bring in fresh air from the outdoors, we can find traffic, construction, agricultural activity, or combustion. All this becomes particulate matter, which basically is pollution. And when we go inside, we not only find that, but we also find indoor combustion of gassing from building materials, water leaks that become mold and bacteria, janitorial products, copy and printing machines. So all these sources of contamination, it's what we need to prevent and then fix. So when we try to consider indoor air quality in a building, we take a holistic approach that extends from where the site is located, what type of orientation are you going to have, where is the air coming into the building, what type of building systems, and the choice of materials. But if I had to narrow this into three strategies, would be first, avoid the source of contamination. Second, provide proper ventilation. Third, filter the air correctly. So,
I'm going to expand on some of that, Alameda, in the following sense that, you gave a great list of things that are causes of air pollution indoors that we should consider. I would include in that biological agents, molds, spores, fungi, allergens from cockroaches and dust mites. So all of these things we're in close contact with in our indoor environments. And then I serve on an advisory board to the Sloan Foundation that started a new program about air chemistry indoors. And they have brought into this field researchers that have made notable discoveries about photochemistry outdoors. And they're asking them now to turn their attention, their instrumentation, their students on to indoor environments. And what they're discovering is phenomenal. The surface reactions that are going on, photochemical chemistry, photocatalytic chemistry stimulated by light on those surfaces, giving rise to organics, giving rise to aldehydes, release of semi-volatiles into the indoor environment. So the complexity of the chemical soup indoors is profound. And this is where research and science lags behind in really understanding what the implications are to our health, because some of the health implications are very subtle.
So the need to care about air quality is huge. And Adamina made a great point on explaining what the general holistic strategy is. So let's go talk about some of the particulars. And during our previous conversations, we identified three issues of critical importance for current buildings that are related with exactly what you were just talking about, Jack: ventilation, moisture, and the materials that we use in the building. And so why don't we start talking about ventilation in particular? And why don't you tell us what are some of the problems that you have faced with ventilation and how should we address them? So Adamina, why don't you start?
Yes. Well, the main issue with ventilation will be the lack of when there is not enough air exchanges or that the mechanical equipment is not well maintained. So what I have found in many of my building retrofits is that the air ducts are completely full of bacteria and microorganisms. I have seen pigeons inside of the air ducts, and I've seen very nasty things. So we first need to design the buildings to have enough air ventilation outside air, but before we get the air outside in, we need to see what type of air. I'll put as an example, when I built, I was involved in the project for Swinnerton Builders in San Francisco. It was a full retrofit of a building, complete gut out, just keeping the structure. And one of the considerations was to have natural ventilation to get as much fresh air inside of the building as possible. But then the building was in an area that was being under construction, and the construction was expected to last all around that building for the next 10 to 15 years. So getting the air out in was not exactly the best thing for the health of the people inside of the building, because the air outside was highly contaminated. So once you measure the outside air and see what you need to get out of it, and what we recommend is having a data gathering station within a mile of the building that get basics like temperature, humidity, ozone, the ground level of ozone and particle count. And then you see what you need to get out. And then you have another indoor real-time monitoring also with the temperature, humidity, ozone, particle count and CO2. That will be the basics. Some strategies and solutions for ventilation will be go well beyond the basics for the code ASHRAE 62.1 of the basic ventilation. And a couple of things that I have seen that work very well in project, one of them will be, again, going to the use of natural ventilation or different type of mechanical systems that don't come from the ceiling, like underfloor air distribution or displacement ventilation, in which basically the air, instead of coming from the ceiling, comes from the floor and allows to naturally rise without mixing the germs into the breathing area. And another one that I have seen lately that I like very much in projects is the dedicated outdoor air systems. Basically, is having a whole ventilation system separate from mechanical cooling and heating. So if the temperature outside is good, sometimes the mechanical ventilations might stop because they don't need to bring in fresh air or hot air. But if you have a completely separate ventilation system, then you always have enough air exchanges.
I like that last point very much. I mean, look at the paradigm for how buildings have been built ever since we, you know, discovered these air conditioning units that combine ventilation and thermal comfort. And we've seen this, I saw a study of brand new homes in California meeting the most aggressive energy codes in California. And these buildings function so well thermally that the duty cycling of the ventilation system was reduced. And they turned out having lower ventilation than you would have ever wanted in a building, and hence higher exposure. So there, some of these things are counterintuitive. But I think that last point you made is a really important design suggestion that should be thought about wherever it's possible. You know, there's so many sort of design elements that we haven't fully anticipated the pathways for airflow and what sources of contamination that might imply.
Absolutely, I completely agree. And I think I forgot to mention that once we have the mechanical systems design, and we know what we need to get rid of in the air in order to breathe it, having the correct filtration system is critical. So there are many types of filters in the market, and they are rated with the MERV, minimum efficiency reporting values. So the recommendation is usually go to the higher MERVs, 13 or above, but there is also within those types, there is a special ones for people that will have allergies or the ones that will be facing odors with carbon activation. And I also like very much when there is UV radiation in the recirculated air that gets rid of the pathogens that you basically find or get into the air when people are sick. So there are many ways that we can ensure that the air that is dirty gets filtered and cleaned before we breathe it again.
I was going to ask you what your opinion was about UV lights and where would you place them in a building system, and what efficacy do you think they have?
It is a pretty new system. I have seen the application more and more every day, and they use it from cleaning. I mean, even for janitorial purposes, they have like an UV kind of magic wand that they pass around the high touch surfaces to clean. And within the mechanical systems, I see that within the ductwork basically it's kind of right in the middle of the dark work, and it's called the well zone, and the air flow goes through that and it cleans the air. About the efficiency of it, well, the testing, and you know more about the university studies, the academia, but the results in the labs are fantastic. And now we are, because it's pretty new, we have to see in the long term how long this will last, or how efficient they are, or how long the UV lamps will last, and the long term in the industry, in the actual buildings.
So yeah, I think you're right. I'm familiar with some of the literature where you, in a hospital setting or a clinic, a waiting room, for instance, there's upper room UV, because you don't want to look at the light in that spectrum because it would be damaging to the eye. So you have to make sure you're protected. But if air gets mixed up in a fairly deliberate way into that zone of UV light, it has the effect of increasing air cleaning. So I think it's funny that it hasn't been utilized as much as I thought it would have been, because it is effective in my estimate, and yours apparently. So maybe it is coming soon.
Yeah, I think it's pretty new for the industry. Usually construction industry doesn't move very quickly on the new developments, and also of course at cost, which goes back to the idea always of the who is going to pay for any enhancements to sustainability.
And we can open it up to our listeners too, like, have you used any of these systems and how have they worked for you, and get back to us on that.
That's a good idea. In fact, we heard of a new LED lighting that'll put it into the near UV, and it should add some sanitation value to this. So there's going to be even more inventions and commercial products available.
Okay, and we should keep an eye open those. And so why don't we move on to our next topic, which was moisture and the issues that that brings.
Well, moisture, you know, we need a lot of moisture or else we get desiccated and dehydrated. So let's just say I'm in favor of moisture, as long as it's not condensing on surfaces. So it's moisture that condenses in places we don't want it to condense. And we see this as a chronic problem. In our surveys that have involved tens of thousands of homes in our population studies across North America, we see the issue of dampness in excess of 50%. That is, 50% of the homes have reported a noticeable condensation on walls and windows, or the smell of dampness. And some of those then go on and report mildew problems. So how we manage dampness, how we measure moisture is still, I think, a critical problem. And the consequence of it is primarily in molds. So there's plenty of nutrients around. There's plenty of spores around. And the one thing that they're looking for is give them a moist surface, and then once they start growing, they can release toxins in themselves. They can release spores that are allergenic. They are digesting and decaying materials, so there's damaging to property. And what comes out of this, and these are studies that have been reported out of the Nordic countries, they've been reported out of the National Academy of Sciences, a whole set of cognitive and respiratory problems are associated with excessive moisture, dampness, mold, mildew.
So Adamina, how do we avoid the condensation issues?
Well, the first thing that I will say is just a regular visual inspection can go a long way. So it's very easy to see where there is condensation, or when you see spots, black spots on the on walls, especially on corners. So that will be the first thing. Then you also want to make sure that you have a water leak detection devices. They are very cheap, and every place that there is going to be water, bathrooms, kitchen, you want to make sure that you have one of these little things underneath, that the moment that there is a leak, it starts beeping. And one critical for construction is doing envelope commissioning. Many of the condensation problems will come because the insulation of the building is not correct. There is a infiltration of untreated air and water intrusions through just simple as rain. So having the proper commissioning, understanding that the envelope is well sealed, goes a long way. And there is very good software available that we use in the construction industry in order to do envelope commissioning that does a combined thermal and moisture analysis. We use particularly Therm, which is from the Berkeley Lab, and it has been working very well. We just need to get more people to do that and take that seriously.
So I'm in total agreement with you, but here's, and you probably have had this experience too, it's over the lifetime of the structure itself. And we've seen situations where you look and say, geez, where is this odor coming from? I don't see any moisture. Well, it's behind the vinyl wall covers. Same way with a wallboard that has paper backing, but that's to the unfinished interior side of the wall cavity. So there are so many unplanned pathways. I'm thinking of our work in public housing. You go into the house, you said, well, it looks pretty reasonable. You pull the dresser away from that exterior wall and you see the silhouette in mold of that structure, of that furnishing. Because that's where the air doesn't get circulated, and that's where the condensation takes place. So if we could solve one thing, once we got rid of smoking indoors, if we could solve one more thing, you're right, it's moisture would be the biggest challenge, I think, with our built environment. And now comes climate change. Look at what is being experienced in Texas, in Florida. These homes are going to dry out. And in that process, they're going to reach the critical moisture content level of these materials, and you're going to get algae blooms like you can't believe. So there are, and we already know this. This has happened with Katrina. It happened with Sandy. Happened with lots of places that are experiencing flooding. These buildings are going to go through a damage cycle until all those materials are removed.
I completely agree. And there is a lot of conversation lately about resiliency in buildings. Well, if we just take care of having good ventilation so that there is no moisture issues, then the buildings are going to be healthier, more energy efficient, and also longer lasting. So for having resiliency, we definitely need to take care of moisture, and moisture in a way is being addressed with having the right ventilation.
Great. So why don't we go to the last topic? And so tell me a little bit more about the issues about the materials that we put into our buildings and their off-gassing.
There are so many things we put in our buildings and then have come to regret putting them in our buildings. So, I mean, urea formaldehyde foam, which is going to be a great saver of energy, right? Then we find out that it off-gasses formaldehyde. We put in asbestos, and that's a great idea. We've used this wonderful product, the PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls. We put it in caulking materials, so that caulking lasts a long time. Little did we know that leaks into the interior environment, and they're still happening. That's the issue. They're still happening with flame retardants. They're still happening with plastic molding and plastic other things we have in our building, products we bring into our building, personal care products. All of these things can contribute to the toxic load, let's put it that way, in a simple fashion. And then if it's in our homes, I guarantee it's in our bodies.
That is absolutely correct. And we have a huge problem with this, about there is so many chemicals of concern and building materials, and we still don't even know many of them, what the safety of those materials are. So my advice will be, if in order to minimize the material toxicity, is first select green materials and then use green cleaning. Sometimes you select a very green carpet, and then the maintenance people come and put a layer of stain resistant on it, and all greenness of that material is gone forever. So we need to first select, and many people will ask me, but how do you select the materials to be less toxic and greener? And that is the question that everyone has. There are many different sources that have been studying this. Coming from a non-chemist, my advice will be trust recognized green building certification labels, green material labels like Cradle to Cradle or Green Guard, Green Seal, CRI, Green Label Plus, BIFMA, Building Green Approved, because these people have been doing the homework and they might not have a longer list of materials, but at least, you know, there are some studies on those. And since we are on the materials, there are many materials in the market that are coming now that actually clean the air. The idea is not just that they will not of gas or they will not have toxics on them, but they will actually clean, like there is for drywall, this drywall sheetrock called AirRenew, and then for exterior coatings there is EcoClean, there for pavements, pavement outside there is EcoGranic. So there is several manufacturers in the market, and this is where I think the market is going, in which you are going to try to first not to contaminate and then clean what you have inside. Plants are also fantastic. I mean, just going to low budget, just have plants inside of the building. They are cleaning, air cleaning machine.
Yeah, clearly the plants could do a decent job with some of the volatile organic compounds. I don't know of any tests that really look at biological cleaning of the semi-volatiles, the plasticizers, the flame retardants, and those things. I don't know if we have evidence there. Let me just add to this guidance, because one can follow to the knowledge as it evolves through Cradle to Cradle or Green Guard or these other labeling. I think we at Harvard have maybe it's a curse and maybe it's an advantage of looking around the corner or over the horizon for those chemicals that we're seeing our fellow faculty are testing, looking at fertility disruption, looking at developmental effects, birth outcome effects. And we see a whole set of chemicals that are acting as these endocrine disruptors for which, you know, it takes time before that preponderance of evidence get back to good guidelines as to whether we should have these or not. And so we've taken, a more proactive stance. And so we have what's called the Harvard Healthy Building Materials Academy, where we're trying to give advice on what vendors should be selected, what product line should be selected, so that our project managers that are overseeing the developments on our campus will now have other choices to make so that we avoid many of these things that we feel are going to be problematic if we don't stop the sources from entering our buildings. So you'll hear a lot more about this in the months to come as we make more of this public.
There is this webpage from Google that it's only available still for the people working on Google projects, which is called Portico. And that is where there is a large database of materials that have been tested for safety. And so there is many sources that are coming up that are trying to make this easier to select.
I'm glad you mentioned that because we're coordinating our efforts with Google to make that Portico more robust. I think you have industry thought leaders like Kaiser Permanente and Google really, I think, trying to push the market to better choices.
So one of the things that comes up when we're talking about all of these great strategies, extra ventilation, filtration, you know, the looking for water leaks, etc., immediately some of the people on the project start thinking about, like, wait, that sounds like more energy, that sounds like more cost. What do you say, Adamina, to them who are worried about the sustainability and the life cycle costs of their projects? How will they be impacted by these strategies?
Well, I will say that sustainability has the three legs. It has the economic part, it has the environmental part, and it has the human part. At least we do get a balance of people healthy into the building. It's not going to be sustainable. Making people sick inside of your building is not sustainable. And I think there are many ways to make your building having better air quality without just pushing more funds that will definitely will have the trade-off, the energy consumption. Simple things like just getting the dedicated outdoor air systems for ventilation or natural ventilation, what about opening the windows, will go a long way without spending more money. So we need to see that in a case-by-case situation. I will never say that it's gonna cost more.
So it's interesting question you ask, because in fact, I'd recommend listeners to look at our website for health, forhealth.org. And we've put onto that website a lot of our recent research. So we found the effects of ventilation through carbon dioxide influencing cognitive performance of people that were in our subjects in our study. So that was interesting in and of itself. No one thought that at low ventilations, high CO2 levels, we'd ever see the effects, but they were there strongly so. But we wrote a companion article that says, well, what is the cost if we were to increase the ventilation, as Alameda said, and go beyond ASHRAE standards, to reduce the CO2 levels and all the other pollutants that we have, moisture included. Turns out that it might be about $40 per person per year, per occupant per year, if you'd increase the ventilation, double the ventilation. But the returns in terms of cognitive performance and productivity was like $6,000. So this strikes us as a false economy to say that we're saving a few dollars through cheap filtration and lousy ventilation at the sacrifice of productivity and health. So put those two things together, it greatly outweighs the cost. The problem has been is who makes those decisions? HR, you know, human resources, and, you know, paying the medical insurance, and you and I, the occupant, pay the medical bills, and the facility manager gets the benefits of the savings, or the building owner gets the benefits of the savings. So there's a disconnect in the decision-making going on here. So the economics is not being accounted for correctly.
Just to close, what would you recommend for those who want to learn more?
I already said check out forhealth.org, and that's a nice supplement to all the good things that are going on with other major rating systems.
I will advise one page, which is greenestsciencepolicy.org, that has a lot of history about the chemicals of concern. And I like what they have is they have a short video series that are just 3 to 4 minutes each, called the 6 classes of chemicals that shouldn't be in the building products. And I think it's a good introduction. And if they want to go further into the how to make the buildings greener and healthier, I will advise them to read the Green Building Rating Systems that focus on that, on health and well-being. And there are 3 on the market that are having a lot of success. One of them is WELL, another FitWELL, and another one RESET. So I'll just leave it to everyone that there is a solution for this. And if you walk into a place and it smells bad, it probably is. So think about how you can fix it.
It was a pleasure talking to Professor Jack Spengler from the Harvard THN School of Public Health and Alameda Rodriguez from AR Green Consulting. Here at USGBC, we care about enhancing indoor air quality, and it is a critical component of one of the major credit categories within the LEED B4 system. Our guests highlighted 3 issues: ventilation, moisture, and material health, and they gave us great strategies to address them. For a deeper dive, you can also check out the Green Buildings and Health, From Lab to the Real World course in the education platform of usgbc.org. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Built for Health by USGBC. Now, we want to hear from you. What was your favorite part of today's episode? What are your best practices and strategies? Share with us on Facebook or Twitter at USGBC. To learn more, visit our website at usgbc.org. Thanks for listening.